here today with Sky.
Hi.
Kara.
Hello.
I'm Kate. And we have a special guest podcaster. This is Mel.
Hey.
Her voice sounds like that.
Yeah. So remember it.
Remember
the differences of our voices.
Yeah, yeah. We're all slightly
I'm
different.
Up here.
Totally. I'm down here. And then it becomes a musical because we're amazing. Okay, guys.
A musical episode. If we have that.
That's our 100th episode.
I remember for the very first episode, your dad thought it was us singing at the beginning. You guys remember?
Yeah. He's stupid.
Go on.
Just kidding. Love you, Dad. Not that you're listening.
He listened to our first one. He doesn't continue.
I did.
Did we not hook him with episode one?
Maybe
Mr.
knowing
Sky?
That it wasn't actually us singing.
Yeah, disappointed. Oh, yeah. So, because we didn't create it ourselves. Which leads me...
Ooh, good.
Thank you. To our theme for the week, which is going to be eventually talking about fanfiction and fan art and fan culture more broadly. Especially through, like, you know, as usual, a feminist and a queer theory lens. But before we get there, we debated for a while about what we could talk about for a living as a feminist question of the week. And we have a few ideas that'll probably crop up in the future, but for this week, we're going to talk specifically about one's approach to being called names on the street, or to name calling. How does a feminist live with name calling?
Or how do they respond to name calling?
Sure.
Yeah.
Kara. And go on. What follow up on that?
Well, I why doesn't Sky start?
Yeah, I'll tell you the story that happened to me recently. So I was
tell you personally.
Tell you, listener. Buckle up.
Come on, guys. Let's be optimistic here.
So
thousands of you.
Yeah, hordes. So I was biking down the street, and I was biking through an intersection. And there was a guy who started to cross the street sort of, like, before, like, the walking sign was on. And so I kept biking through the intersection because the light was green, and I biked behind him. So, like, even though he wasn't actually doing anything right, I in no way obstructed his path at all. And then I just heard, like, cunt, like, really angrily and yelled. So I turned around, and he was, like, yelling it at me. And I was, like, really startling because I, like, didn't even think that there was an altercation, and... nobody's, like, angrily yelled that at me before. And so it was just sort of, like, a really interesting and staggering moment where I was like, what do I do?
Sure. What did you do?
I just kept biking.
It's cool. It's cool.
Couldn't react quick enough.
I mean, now looking back on it, how would you have responded if you had the time to, like, think and deliberate?
I think that in that particular, like, so we can talk about it more, but for me, it's a context-specific situation. Like, I think that, for me, it was, like, a decision point of evaluating my goals of, like, being, like, one, do I want to get to where I'm going, or do I want to, like, fight, you know, like, this feminist sort of fight right now, and do I think that would affect change with this particular individual person who clearly is angry enough to call me a cunt? And I don't think that it would have affected change, so I probably would still have kept going. But in a different context, and maybe not.
Yeah, and that's interesting of, like, to affect change, you think that you have to affect other people, but couldn't there be something said of just the act of you doing it yourself is an act of change?
I'm wondering also about, like, the difference in between, Sky, which I think you were touching on, the idea of someone who's saying something in, like, the context wherein it's, like, out of... kind of this altercation which they perceive but you didn't perceive versus something where you're, like, on the same level and actually communicating. Like, this is,
yeah.
I don't know.
Like, if you're having a fight with someone and they get mad and call you that.
Sure. There's different textures to it, and obviously all of them are inappropriate, but...
Yeah, and then the other thing is that, like, we've talked about, like, or mentioned that, like, a lot of us have been called, like, dyke by random people driving by on the street or those kinds
of
things.
Yeah, is that all of us? Because, like...
We were together, us three, and it happened one time.
So it's like,
did we talk about who it was?
And I know Melanie said it.
Like, it wasn't you, Sky. Like, it wasn't you.
Yes.
So I guess anyone else have any thoughts about this?
Whenever this happened with me, I've just, like, kept walking. Because my concern is always about safety, too. So there's, like, confronting the person and talking. I don't know what I would say to them. But also, like, my concern with, like, my immediate safety. Because if someone's, like, I don't know, willing to yell obscene things at you on the street, then, like, how far away are they from, like, punching you in the face or something? Especially when it's, like, something that's very gendered, really, like, or...
Yeah, I guess that's what I wanted.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So, and, like, how homophobia ties into gender as well. So.
Especially with the history of, like, homophobic insults being, like, thrown at people. It's a little different from the history of, like, cunt. Hey, did you say cunt, or is that the first time we said
no,
it?
No, I said it.
Okay. I was like,
C-word!
I have to put this in the notes. It's an R-rated episode. Don't let your children hear this one.
Yeah, please. This is the one when kids are going to get cut off. I guess, actually, what I was trying to touch on with these guys, like, the difference in between someone that you're, like, talking to face-to-face, like, using really intense language with you, and someone that is on the street, because there is always the matter of, like, preserving your life.
You totally
Which is, like, a difficult texture to lead to any sort of discourse.
I think if it was the case, depending on the mood that I was in, if I was feeling, like, especially aggressive, maybe.
Strong, if you're feeling
aggressive.
If
I was feeling
strong
and confident, I would probably yell back at whatever person, especially if I was, like,
what would you yell
on a bike. I'd just be like, fuck you.
Right.
Like, I wouldn't say anything like, hey, I'm actually not,
let's sit down and talk about it!
Yeah, exactly. But now I will yell down, do you want to have a conversation about this?
You're misinformed about the politics of that word!
Yeah. But if it was, like, in an argument with someone that I actually knew, I would be, like, so shocked. You know, if someone was like, fucking cunt, I'd be like, what? I wouldn't even know what to say.
Especially someone who knows you for more than, like,
minutes
would be like, you'd be like, do you know what you said to me? Do you know the impact of what?
That's true. There's actually also, like, a texture there to when people have sort of had the background that I would say we have, where it's a different insult altogether.
Yeah, and it's, like, an intense, like, well, I just don't think I know a lot of people who would, like, yell at me in a fight, like, in my personal, like, my personal relationships, but it is such a way to, like, undercut you. Like, anything you say, I'm, like, reduce you. Like, it's such a...
Well, it is, like, sometimes... literally reducing you to, like, female body parts.
Right, exactly. So, so I don't know. And then the other thing with, like, so there's definitely I would, like, respond to it if it was said to me in a personal context one-on-one with, like, someone I know well. But in terms of someone on the street, I agree. Of course there's the issue of safety. And then second to that, it's also, like, the issue of responsibility is, like, why should I be responsible for correcting this person when I'm, like, the victim? And, but then if I'm not responsible, then who is responsible? And when is that going to get done? Like, are the random pedestrians who are around and just heard it, are they supposed to do something? Or, like, who should really take the ownership to fixing this fucked up person, basically?
Everyone. Including that person themselves.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But it definitely not all on the singular person. But I think it's, like, as I said as my first comment, I don't think that we should look at it always as, like, how are we going to affect this other person? Mm. But, like, how does it give you your own response to being called something like that? And how you respond regardless of who's talking. You know, to have it actually be about you as a person feeling whatever things you feel at being called this. Instead of internalizing it or just, like, shrugging it off or something.
I mean,
how do you feel it?
Like, as a human being, regardless of what I'm called when I'm, like, biking, and if it's about, like, someone, like, honking at me in their car on, like, if it's about, like, being hit on from cars, or if it's about me, like, jaywalking, like, no matter what it is, I always yell back at the person, just sort of incoherently, but I'm, like, I'm the type that always yells back, but I'm not sure if that really is better. Like, that's just, like, my personal instant response to people, like, throwing things in my face as I throw them back. And so I'm not convinced that what I do is any better. It's not silence, but it's also not constructive. It's just me to, you know.
It can't, like...
I think it is. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go
ahead. I was gonna say, like, I think that there is something to it, though. Like, again, if you're in a safe space, and I don't think that I don't mean to convey the message that all people should do this, but when people catcall you or they yell, like, dyke at you from their window, a lot of the time it's serving similar functions, which is just sort of, like, a power function.
Right, and I guess the fact that I just automatically conflated those two things probably says something. Where, like, I consider anything yelled from a car complimentary or,
or like
insultingly to be the same dialogue. Like, I think those people are assholes regardless.
And I think that's probably partially true in a way. And it's like, it like, whether they're calling you like hot or a dyke, they're wielding a form of privilege over you.
And they're expecting you not to answer because you're the silent person.
Yeah, they are silent. So by like yelling even an incoherent thing, like some ridiculous
stuff. And my parents both went to exactly what I do.
Exactly. Like anything, like in a way you are, I think, kind of undermining that power grab. And so that might be, from a theoretical standpoint, like actually an interesting response.
I was just thinking in terms of, like, you know, like, the whole, like, theory shit about, like, being hailed into something. So, like what I tend to do is, not only because, like, I'm concerned about my safety, but I tend to pretend I didn't hear them, because, like, I feel like in some ways, if I just don't respond to that, then it's like, well, who are you talking to? Obviously not me, and I don't even, like, allow them to make me into that dyke or that cunt or whatever
calling
at me. And I mean, I think there's different ways that you can sort of approach that, and I wonder sometimes if they're looking for a rise, and, like, by responding as you do, that's one way of calling them out.
I absolutely agree with that, which is why I think that not, like, I don't think responding is necessarily the thing to do, because it is, like, creating a correspondence and creating a transaction that maybe they're seeking. What is your method of acting like you didn't hear? Do you just keep walking, or do you like look at your watch? Do you
I just like keep walking. I usually kind of like play with my phone.
You like look at a bird really intensely. You're like, I've been focusing on that for ages.
Just change in no way.
I just like don't like change my pace if I'm walking, or like in any way like try to show any visible signs of reacting or hearing. And I don't turn around and see who said it to me or whatever. I just keep going. And sort of act as though, like, well, you can't possibly be talking to me because, like...
See, that's interesting, because there's all, like, we're actually all representing very different politics about...
I think that they're all... I think what's interesting is, like, both of these maybe, let's say, oppositional points, which is, like, to yell back or to pretend that you don't notice, aren't actually opposition at all. And both of them are...
Function.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're serving the same function, And it all does depend on, like, situationally and personally, what makes you personally feel the best, you know?
Yeah.
But I guess there are ways in which you shouldn't respond, which is, like, looking and smiling, you know?
Sure.
Just nicely.
Well, thank you.
I do look good today.
I don't know.
Or, like, I do look...
If a guy yelled at you angrily and called you a cunt, maybe, like, waving and smiling would be an effective response.
Yeah.
I don't know. I also know that, like, typically my response to someone calling me a cunt would be to be like, good one, buddy, and then, like, keep going.
I actually don't think I've ever been called a cunt. Ever in, like, the history of my life. I mean, to my face, obviously.
I wish, Scott, I had just shared an awkward, like, glance. That would have been amazing.
I don't remember anybody ever doing that.
I don't think I have been in, like, the heat of passion. I don't think it's ever been a direct insult. But, like, maybe, because also, like, if I had been, I would have been like, good one, buddy, and kept biking, so.
I feel like I would become really irrationally angry if someone called me.
Oh my god, you would have hulked out.
I probably would have. I feel like I would want to, like, punch someone in the face if they did that.
Nice.
It would probably be an inappropriate response, but, like...
Yeah. What? I think we have decided that whatever makes you feel best is the most appropriate response.
That would be a very valid response, be angry. I was like...
Guys, I'm really sorry.
Go on.
Scary.
Yeah.
But I actually wonder, too, if maybe it depends on... It's not, like, our response that's the best response, maybe it's however the other person's interpreting it. Right? Because, like, your response to getting angry and my response to silence would have different effects depending on how they interpret those.
Yeah, and though so, I do also have to say mine's less getting angry and more just, like, not, like, ignoring,
I guess, is more
my impulse.
I think in the ideal world, like, if you can do this in a safe way, it's great to do whatever disrupts what they're trying to do.
That's the thing. If the
but
politics
you have to know
are
what they're trying to do.
That's totally true. If someone's trying to wrest power by making you uncomfortable, either thing, like either ignoring or saying a thing displaces that idea that they're uncomfortable. If they're just like if they're looking for some sort of like submissive response, they being the car heckler that I've constructed in my mind.
But again, I don't think that we have to focus so much on, like, this individual person that's doing it, because it's more about the culture and how we're reacting to it, rather than trying to change this one person. Because this one person that's yelling cunt at us is, no matter what we do, probably not going to care
very
much.
This one dick. Am I right? Am I right, guys?
Who's yelling cunt at us.
But what do we have, like, beyond the individual than our individual response in that situation? Like,
I mean, instead of focusing on, like, what do I think, what should I do to change this person's mind? Just be like, what would I do to make me the most comfortable going through this, like,
awful thing? So broadly speaking, are you saying just the idea of
don't
someone
be, like,
reacting?
Dick-centered is what you're saying.
Yeah.
The idea.
Us, the concentric.
The concentric. So someone reacting more personally rather than in response to someone just like embracing their own reaction.
Yeah.
Or their own impulses.
However
to react.
They feel comfortable reacting. Just react that way. Whatever.
Whatever, man. It's all good.
Another thing that I do too, actually, and I sort of remembered, is that like, I often actually just go to Facebook and then we'll share my stories of like shit that happens to you that is like oppressive or shitty in some way.
Yeah.
Totally. You know, I'll share the story and then just like talking about it with other people. Sometimes like, you know, maybe your roommates don't think about what they say and how they might, you know, be offensive people or shitty people. And sort of like, you know, you go to Facebook to vent and like to share these funny stories, but also you can use that as a way to like actually maybe affect change by like having people sort of confront these issues, these things that happen on a daily basis and kind of realize.
Exactly. I think
so,
it's
like,
nice that there, you could change it, you could still use that energy and change it in alternate ways that isn't directed at that one single person.
Actually, yeah, and if I can just add one awesome thing about that, I don't know if you guys have heard of that app Holoback. Have you guys heard of it?
No.
No.
It's a really cool idea. I hope that's what it's called.
It sounds like an app,
yeah,
I mean.
It's this app that I think that what you can do is if somebody does catcall you from a car, you can post your story or you can take a picture of the car or the person and post it. And then there's like this mini feed and it's like this kind of community of people basically like sharing stories and almost like sort of shaming those people and sort of calling them out, but within this like safe online community,
awesome.
I think is
that's
a really interesting like thing.
That's been happening
yeah.
a lot on the internet recently. I mean, a lot in comparison to it not happening. Because it's still not the majority, obviously. But someone was on a... I told someone here the story. I don't think it was on a podcast, but I'm going to repeat it. Somebody recently was on a dating site, and they were talking with this guy. And then this guy just randomly, out of nowhere, they were actually talking about the weather, sends her a dick pic. And she was like, no thanks, I don't want this. And he's like, you know, goes on of calling her a prude or like, come on, it's just my dick. And she finds him on Facebook, sends the convo to his mother. And then, you know,
that's
takes back
justice.
In terms of pernicol, oh, I can totally
take back the dick pic.
I have an acquaintance of mine recently was called a cunt by someone on Facebook in a comment thread.
Wow.
And as a response, one of her friends is signing up the guy who said it to a lot of weird porn sites. So I guess
maybe he'll appreciate it though.
Yeah, he's like, yeah,
yeah,
it's my jam. Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting idea, like politicizing online activity. Interesting. And another way to politicize the online is through a fan culture. The theme of today's podcast, which is going to be, I think very broadly covering just the ideas of fan fiction, fan art, communities erected around creation of these things. But I guess because it's such a broad topic, we should just start specifically with maybe some personal experiences or like our personal intersections with the idea of fandom.
I'll go first.
Okay.
Sky, if you would care to go first.
I don't read a lot of fan fiction.
But
it's a lot.
What does a lot mean? What do you read?
I don't actually read any, but when I was
You read any? Yeah.
Sure.
One time I did.
Let's go historically.
Single time.
Do you want to hear about my foray into fan fiction?
Yes. Please, yes.
I love that it was one time, so it must have been bad for you.
No, it was so fulfilling at the time. I was 12 or something, but I was watching Gilmore Girls, and this is spoilers before Rory and Jess kissed, and I really wanted them to
spoiler kiss. Rory and Jess kissed.
Guys, sorry about the spoiler for Gilmore Girls.
A really big bomb that we just dropped.
Guys, let's predict all the spoilers that will happen with our fan fiction predictions, because spoilers for
Harry Potter,
Lord of the Rings,
Gilmore
Girls.
I like this idea of spoiling really old shit. Anyway, so yeah, so then I read some fan fiction. It was really great.
So it was it like wish fulfillment or?
Yeah, it was like of them like making out and stuff. And I remember
is it because
being like, that's awesome.
Did you?
And I don't know if it was fan fiction or if I thought that it was actually just something that happens on the show and I was confused.
What?
I mean, they do kiss on the show.
Sorry, are you talking about you dreamt a thing and you thought it was fan fiction because you want to relate to us? What are you saying?
No, I was
like, I had a dream once.
I was reading it on the internet and I don't think I knew what really fan fiction was. So I read it and I thought at first, I think that like this was like the show writers like writing something. And then I learned later that it was fan fiction. I was very disappointed. But then later they do kiss and then I was fulfilled again.
I really don't think they would have like leaked the script online though.
Yeah.
And so, also not in prose form.
I didn't understand.
On fanfiction.net.
Over to you.
I love that you try to convince yourself otherwise.
Like, guys, I have insider information. I found the most amazing website. There's lots of potential storylines, but one of them has to be the right one.
Yep.
Mel?
Okay. I actually just, like, stumbled across, I guess, my first bit of fan art this year. Like, I was writing a paper on Julie Andrews and Mary Poppins, and I found, like, that... I think I've shown Kara the pictures of, like, Mary Poppins making out with Ms. Frizzle from the Magic School Bus.
So elaborate on this forever.
So that's like the kind of the first time I kind of really thought about it, I guess. And then I actually just like the other night looked up to see if I could find any actual fan fiction written about Ms. Frizzle and Mary Poppins, and I did. And I read it. Yeah, there was like some actual really terrible fan fiction written about Ms. Frizzle specifically. Kind of, it was really gross. And then there was Ms. Frizzle and Mary Poppins, and it was, like, them going on their first date, and, like...
I just didn't realize until this second that I shipped them, because they would have the best first date, everything would be magical, and they would teach so many lessons.
What was it called? A perfect date, or...
Yeah, did I send it to you?
Something really cute.
You and, like, Julia. Yeah. Anyways, it was, like, it was really, like... They actually did a really good job of, like, capturing, like, what Mary Poppins is like and what Miss Frizzle is like. And, like, if they got together, what that might kind of, like, the beginning of a date look like. And, like, even, like, Liz, like, pops in and, like, whatever.
Carlos. Arnold!
Yeah, I think actually the students set them up. I can't remember, though, but they made
them. Oh, of course they do. They're so wise.
But then it, like, stops. It actually, like, ends right when, like, they're, like, dancing at, like, a club or something. Not a club, but, like...
Definitely a club!
At a bar that Mary Poppins would, like, approve of. So it's kind of a classy jazz lounge or something. And they start dancing together, and they kind of realize that maybe you have these sparks, even though Ms. Frizzle's, like, really odd, and, like, Mary Poppins is very, like, proper. And then you're, like, you're waiting for them to, like, kiss and then, like, hook up. And then, like, the story ends. And it just left me wanting so much more. So I Googled
you should write fan fiction for that fan fiction. See,
yeah.
That's the thing. Filling
yeah.
in those blanks.
So I was sharing this with a friend. And we were like, oh, my God, we have to make this happen. Like, how can we, like, get them together? And we were like, let's just write what we want to read. And then now
I
understand.
Did you? Did
no,
you do this?
No, it was 2 days ago. And I have, like, a MRP proposal to do. So
sure. Get over that.
Yeah.
School.
Something I have to do.
Right.
Ms. Frizzle and Mary Poppins need to kiss.
I know.
So,
no,
drop what you're doing.
The
but what
internet
I enjoy
needs
is like,
them to
writing.
Kiss.
Yeah.
Or but that's actually a really interesting experience because, like, the point at which you got to where you wanted to create art based on a thing was after the fan fiction was unfulfilling, which is, like, cooler than when I was just, like, watching Lord of the Rings. I was like, I guess that's not enough for me. You know what I mean? Like, it was like, no, like... The two fictional characters from very different eras, might I add. How did they bridge that gap?
I don't know. I think, like, well, Mary Poppins, if you watch the film and, like, probably read the books, I haven't read them, she, like, sort of defies time.
She's
space.
A Time Lord. Oh my God.
Wow, that's another
I actually wrote an entire paper about her queering time, so.
Queering time!
Yeah.
Oh shit, why is that a concept I've never
heard? Because, like, you know that there's that song.
Maybe she just made it up.
And Mary Poppins, Step in Time. I feel like there's
queer
like
in
some
time.
Pun there with
well,
like queering time.
Yeah, there is. Well, there's a whole thing with her and Bert. Like, you don't know if they
were
ever romantically connected.
Or you're
jumping
to a chalk painting, guys.
Yeah, exactly. That's
which
how.
Is pretty.
I've never seen.
Yeah,
me
no,
neither.
No,
I've totally
no,
never
no,
seen.
No,
there's
no
a thing
idea
of,
what's
there's
happening.
A thing with birds, I think.
Oh my God. No,
that's crazy. It's so
crazy.
We're
talking about The Sound of Music.
I wrote the queerness
Julie
Andrews
is also in that. Yeah.
So
oh.
I looked at The Sound of Music and Mary Poppins and how
sure.
they were both queer in their various ways.
Mm.
I forget what I was saying.
Kate, you talked about Lord of the Rings. Yeah. And you wrote Lord of the Rings. Why don't we go into your personal
backstory? Sure. I mean, it's dense. There's dense
layers.
So
you don't have to go into too many details.
No, I shan't.
You don't have to name every single one that you ever wrote.
I couldn't.
I couldn't either.
I could probably name a couple. I won't. but the thing is that when I first started getting into fan culture, it was definitely not in a sexual way, and it wasn't, like, looking at sexual stories. It became that somewhat sometimes, or became romantic sometimes, but, like, I just went in looking for more stories in the universe, and so after I'd, like, watched the Lord of the Rings films and read the books, like, not the Silmarillion, because I was, like, 11, and let's be honest, that book is dense as fuck, but after a certain point, I just wanted to, like, be more involved in the universe, which I still, like, have the impulse towards when I'm done with the media or a piece of art.
Me too.
And I just kind of don't want that world to stop existing once I'm done consuming the official version of it. So I just, like, I don't even know how I stumbled upon fanfiction.net. I assume it would have been just by Googling. And then I sort of started reading stuff, was like, oh, I can probably write this, wrote stuff, and other 12-year-olds loved it.
How do you know they were 12?
I made friends with one of them, they lived in Edmonton.
Oh my god, that's really cute.
Yeah.
Did you meet in real life?
We did meet in real life, and then a couple years later I met a friend of a friend, they were like, hey, I heard you met my friend through Lord of the Rings fanfiction. I was like,
awesomely embarrassing. Like, if I was 16, I would have been like, what?
I definitely was like, well, I mean, I was like, what can you do? So
yeah, I guess.
I admitted to it.
You're like, please don't tell anyone.
But for me it was also, I remember there was this one time I was writing a, like, long series, so there was chapters that I was publishing every day or two.
You wrote a chapter a day? Oh my god.
Something like that. I was so prolific. And I was getting, like, a ton of reviews, generally positive.
This was for Lord of the Rings?
Yes, yes. And it was a general thing, though. People were like, it seems a little homoerotic there, going to Legolas there, which, like, let's be honest, how can you resist? But I remember my mom being like, hey, why are you leaving dinner so quickly? Like, you seem so happy. Do you have, like, a boyfriend? Like, are you going upstairs to talk to your boyfriend? I wasn't. I was going upstairs to read my fanfiction reviews, which I love thinking about it because that's so much better. And then I spent a few years kind of just, like, not doing anything. And then recently I've been re-encountering that world because I find it more interesting than ever, and I think there's a lot of interesting politics at work, and...
Yeah, it was once kind of, or maybe it was just because we were so young, but it felt a little bit more underground. Like, there was no Tumblr dedicated to, Sherlock.
It definitely was more underground back,
shipping is, like, common knowledge.
Sure, and it's like, I mean, shows are also... television has, like, metatextual commentary about this universe, which didn't happen back in the day. But also, I mean, like, fan fiction has existed since the 1900s, and this isn't a new practice, it's just a practice that is, as everything is, being more broadly disseminated because of the internet. And so, back in the day...
The first fan
fiction. Oh my god, it was mostly Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, yeah.
Way back in the day, for sure. And then the first zines that were published were Star Trek. Like, everything that would happen,
Star Trek,
did.
Knew was, like, early for the culture, but I wonder, it's, like, also, how do you even define fan fiction? Because at a certain point in history, like, things were not authored by certain people. Like, you know, there was common stories, and they were changed by people, and adding their own little things.
So what I wanted to bring up is actually...
When are we going to get to my history?
What I wanted... Sorry, Kara?
It's okay.
What's your personal relationship to
what
fan
did you
fiction?
Want to bring up? Remember it.
I will.
Okay. The first fan fiction I ever really got into was, like, Harry Potter, and that was because, like, it was kind of midway after maybe the first three books. I was, like, 10 or 11, and I just wanted to go online and, like, look at theories.
It was speculative.
What was gonna
I totally did that as well.
So I just, like,
just
started on the forums.
Yeah.
And then the
which
forums,
were amazing.
Yeah,
Harry Potter forums
really
back in the day were intense.
And something we'll talk about after is, like, J.K. Rowling actually, like, looked at the forums and, like, commented on them and stuff. Not
she
had,
on
her, but under, like,
oh, and she had a relationship with, like, MuggleNet, and, she was in correspondence with her fans.
And so then I just started writing fan fiction and consuming it, but being so ashamed of it.
Sure.
You know, it was such a source of shame, and I definitely stopped by the time I was, like, 14 in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I did other things like Star Wars and stuff.
You know what? I just remembered that I did stop by around high school, but it actually wasn't as private a transaction as I thought, because once I started getting into the, like, homoerotic and more sexual stuff, man on man, just so y'all know, I...
It's really important for us to know.
Everyone.
Thank you for playing that.
I had a couple friends who I would, like, send stuff to, and we would talk about it, which is totally weird, because I wouldn't do that anymore. That's not... Like, even though I consider myself to be, like, a more open person and less ashamed of, like, these impulses, and definitely more,
ashamed of the impulses.
just to be elves and rangers. just loving each other. But I guess more, like, I'm much more open about my sexuality and my sexual urges, but I probably still, like, nowadays I wouldn't read, like, a hot fan fiction and be like, hey, Kara, just wait. Your evening's set. Whereas back in the day, I would kind of have that transaction when I was much more pre-sexual. That's interesting to me about myself.
Great.
What I was going to say, though, is that what I find interesting, and I do, like, I really enjoy interrogating, like, the history of fan culture. And something I find particularly interesting is the intersection between adaptation and fan fiction, and that point at which, like, the author is dissolved not because someone is appropriating for their own gains, or, like, what that means, I guess. Like, when something is adapted unofficially, and how unofficial adaptations can become dominant. Like, there's a lot of ties in here to, like, a feminist history, and I just wondered what thought we had about that. We all have one thought.
I have a single thought, but it has nothing to do with feminism.
Sure. Or we can do queer, and that's it.
No, it doesn't personal? Have anything either. Just, now I've lost it.
Ha!
I think that's,
No, I remember now.
Go ahead, Kara.
No, go ahead. I interrupted you to tell everyone that I remembered. So go ahead.
So, I think it's, I love it. I love this idea. It's sort of like a multiplicity of discourses, or like this like proliferation of voices around a narrative. And
yeah, it's still around a single narrative.
True, but it's like it's not really revolving around it so much as like riffing off of it. It's like taking one thing and building and building and building. And that thing has, like, obviously come from and built from other things. So, obviously, like, I just think it's a really great... I think that there are very direct links to sort of, like, post-structuralism and feminism. I can't really articulate what they are. But I just think that this idea of, like, a multiplicity of voices is, like, a really important one. And the idea that there is, like, yes, a single author, but in other ways, not just one author. Or there's ways of kind of identifying that.
Yeah, what I like is the idea that, like, there's a rejection of a single narrative. And so it's polyglottal. There's,
Well, I don't know if it is a rejection, because there's alternate universe stuff, but there's also, like, very... This follows canon.
Sure, but even within following canon, it is a break from the story that is the one that was authored by the author. Mm-hmm. And so, like, breaks from canon still exist within certainly the universe, and stories are often praised for their merits of being within canon or being within character, but they're not the story that was already told. They're still something else.
I wonder how, what I was thinking of before, and it ties in, I wonder how... the idea of, like, anxiety of influence, has to do with, like, fan fiction, or defining what fan fiction is at all. Yeah. Because so many stories, and especially, I think, like, in fantasy, or maybe in everything has, like, that same narrative. You know, people think that everything is Shakespeare, just updated. Yeah. You know, kind of these, like, common threads just redone over and over and over, and so how can anything really be original, and then how can anything purely be fan fiction? Like, I don't think the lines are as blurry, but in terms of the less theoretical and, like, more cultural aspects of fan fiction, there's obviously a very specific line until, like, 50 Shades of Grey.
Right, and so 50 Shades of Grey, to fill in, I guess, anyone who doesn't know about this, was... Like, its inception was as Twilight fan fiction, and we had a podcast about Twilight, and I think we've all sort of, like, touched on our relationship to that text and that film. But then this book that became very, very popular is a way to capitalize and, to make money off of what began as basically what we've been previously describing as a reappropriation of a text. So
I don't know. I of course there's like capitalistic influences.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it was. Do you think it was purely for money?
I do. I think what happened. Like, I could be getting this wrong, but I think what happened was that it was so popular on the internet that a publisher was like, "We're like signing you up. We're going to publish you because
I think
you need like these books that will sell a lot to publish."
It was something like that. I think that it was also a small publisher too, or perhaps a self-published thing. There's some.
Was it?
And I'm not entirely sure on it, but it definitely wasn't one of like the big houses that published this text. It was a nichier publisher, so I'm not sure if there was also an aspect of, like, recognizing... I'm totally speaking out of my ass, but it definitely wasn't, like, a random house that published it with a smaller publisher.
I actually think it might now be a bigger publisher, just even just, like, for them to be able to put out so many units.
Yeah. Sure.
Now they need, like, a larger publisher.
Yeah, maybe that changed over.
I feel like my roommate works for, like, Simon & Schuster, and I feel like he was talking about how, like, Fifty Shades allowed some big publisher to put out, you know, the newest, I don't know, Margaret Atwood or whatever, something that wouldn't sell as well.
Yeah,
so,
that's interesting.
Margaret Atwood, but like something more literary and less.
Sure, I'm totally speaking just like of a thing I thought I read, and maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe I could be wrong too.
Whatever, so. We're both so accepting of each other.
But let's reel it into like feminist theory. Do you guys have any specific thoughts? I've never read 50 Shades of Grey. We might have talked about that. Have you read it, Mel?
No, I haven't actually. That's one of the few really popular novels that I haven't read.
Have you read the Twilight books?
I have actually. Yes.
All of them?
Yes.
I commend you.
You what?
I couldn't get through the first one. I was bored.
Well, I was working in a bookstore and like you kind of have to know what people are reading.
Yeah.
So I read the first two because the third one I think was coming out, and then at that point I wanted to know what's happening.
Yeah.
So I just continued with the series.
Fair enough.
Have you watched the movies? They're the best.
No, I haven't.
Specifically, actually. The fourth one.
Really?
So I'm actually really good.
Curious to see how they adapted it into film, but I haven't actually
crazy
seen it.
Amazingly.
Yeah, they adapted it really well.
I just want to see like them like glowing like diamonds or whatever.
Yeah, it's not as impressive.
Yeah,
don't go for that reason.
Yeah, don't.
That was like my only
reason.
Go for it. You have to go for the right reasons, like watching how great it is and watching everyone subvert it. See our latest podcast on it.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll send out a link.
We should post a link. What is the author's name that wrote,
Oh my god.
50 Shades?
Yeah.
James? I think E.L. James. I think
yeah.
That might be a pseudonym, though. I don't think that's their real name.
Is it a woman or a man?
Woman.
Or,
I think it's a woman.
It's a woman.
So, sorry, was someone else going to say something?
No, go ahead.
One of the things that I like about adaptation / fanfiction, is that I think that it's an interesting way to pull things out of narratives and then recontextualize them in some other way. So,
mm-hmm.
like, whether it's, like, a temporal context, like, modern day or whatever, but even, like, less literal, like, more of, like a feminist context, or put a, kind of transpose a character from whatever they're within into a context that's maybe more relevant to like, readers of fan fiction.
Or even just to the author, which is a political act as well.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I think, yeah, it is a political act, and it does some really interesting things in terms of, yes, having multiple voices and multiple authors, but also just, like, messing with, like, temporality and linearity in narrative, and, like, disrupting the flow and pacing of narrative, which can be, like, a really interesting act that I think has implications for, like, both feminism, of course, and like, you know, like, queerness.
And yeah, and I think what stands out the most for me within fanfiction culture is, like, the dominance of inserting Mary Sues, which are, like, perfect women characters who are, like, original characters, and / fiction, you know,
mm-hmm.
of, like, how prevalent those two tropes are, which
mm-hmm.
I think kind of, like, lends itself to... It just shows how women aren't usually the protagonists of, like, these fantasy things that people
yeah.
are writing fan fiction about, at least up until the last, like, couple of years when women in fantasy and vampires and stuff has been much more dominant. But it's kind of, like, carving out that space where women and queerness and other modes can exist within that same world.
Yeah.
Like, taking that lens of the world and that not narrative and just being like, here's my place too, and going your way through it.
And kind of rerouting what the story that was officially told was. I read this, there's this amazing online environment, or I guess institution, which is the Organization for Transformative Works, which is an academic journal, but also which owns Archive of Our Own, which is like a kind of...
Archive of Our Own?
Yeah, I know. I know. Which is like a fanfiction.net that is like, I guess, a little bit classier or a little bit more academically guided in terms of philosophy. And they have several other subsidiary websites, including Fanlore, I believe, is them, which is like an attempt to archive a history of fan works. So to have each...
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's amazing. This, like, I give them money. I love
them.
Well,
even TV Tropes, like, they have a little section where you can look at the popular tropes within
fan fiction,
for
sure.
Which I think is really interesting.
It's amazing. But they published a journal, which, and I, like, just to back up, like, I'm a giant fan of fan fiction and fan culture, and I generally think that the idea of taking a media that you like and doing anything to it, no matter what it is an interesting, positive thing to do. But that said, I read this really good article in an OTW journal, which was about the television series Queer as Folk, which, spoilers for Queer as Folk.
I haven't seen it.
Spoilers.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and it was like a very formative show for me. Like, I watched it when I was like 12 with my close friends, when we were sort of like interrogating our sexuality and trying to figure out how the world worked, and this was our first experience with anything that wasn't like heterosexuality, which, like, whatever that's worth. But at the end of that show, the two like protagonists who are romantically involved seem like they're going to have a fairy tale ending and don't, and that was a conscious decision by the writers of the show to have an ending that was like usurping the norm, according to the writers of the show in articles. Where, and then so the journal piece I read was about that popularly, Queer as Folk fan fiction rejected the queer ending and tried to make a more traditionally heteronormative romantic ending for these characters, which I found very interesting because I generally look at, especially... slash fan fiction as being like an interesting queering and a derailing of heteronormative values, but there was this impulse in this show that was explicitly trying to do something queer with their narrative, and the fan culture was about rejecting that queer narrative because it was narratively unfulfilling. And I found that really interesting against my personal politics of fan fiction as a positive thing.
Yeah, I of course am unfamiliar with the show and the fan fiction culture, but I don't know if I would call it narratively unfulfilling, because I don't know if people thought if the desire to write more is a desire to be filled,
sure.
Like there's something lacking in it.
Mm.
There's another exploratory into alternate.
Right,
modes.
Certainly. And I would just posit that a lot of this would be like the fact that if any series that ends with like the characters who seem like they'll get together don't.
Right.
Which is what happened.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, like maybe that's not what the point is. Maybe it's just the idea of anything that ends like missing it.
Yeah. I mean, it can probably serve both of those functions. I think it is probably true that there is a lot of fan fiction that's like trying to finish something or fill a hole that bothers them in the narrative or like correct something that they felt was like a misstep or something like that in a way. And then there's probably a lot of other fan fiction that's like riffing off a narrative that they actually liked or like trying to amplify or build or go in a different direction, but not because they disagree with the original narrative per se, but they want to do something like alongside with.
I find it very rare that anyone gets involved in a fan culture, or at least this sort of creative fan culture, which is like making Tumblrs or writing fan fiction or making fan art, if there is something that they like disagree with. Usually they'll go on the forums and like write something really angry, you know?
Yeah.
That's it. That's their way of correcting it rather than creatively correcting something.
Though there is within fan culture a trope which is like a fix it, which or a coda, which are
right.
things too. Like that is like those tropes do exist and the language does exist for solving that. Sorry.
Yeah, well with the Queer as Folk example specifically, like I remember watching the finale and being like really upset. But I kind of,
totally.
Yeah, no, but at the same time, like I suppose like yeah, they're being true to like Brian's character. Sorry to give away a little bit of the I guess.
Whatever, no, spoilers for Queer as Folk. It's
fine.
No one cares about that show anymore, I promise.
I've actually been rewatching it right now, like,
nice.
In life. Anyways.
I think I own it all.
But I think, but on the one hand, like, it's kind of like the writers were trying, I guess, maybe, because they do a queer writing of the ending, and then people wanting to go and create, like, a homo, or I guess a homonormative
yeah.
ending. But at the same time, though, I think maybe there's also speaking to, like, the space for possibilities within fan fiction, because specifically with queer scope, the like and queer fiction and stories, the endings aren't usually happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the ending to Queer as Folk wasn't necessarily a happy ending, per se. So while it was a very normative, or while people were wanting it as a normative ending, it's also kind of speaking to, like, this new possibilities of ways of maybe being queer in the world that doesn't necessarily end in, like, someone dying or losing the person you love or whatever, because that's a
very
really
interesting
narrative in that literature, especially, like...
Lesbians always die.
Yeah, I think, like, up until, like, Ruby Fruit Jungle, like, I forget when that was written in the 80s or something... Like, the lesbian main character always died or
yeah, like
killed
the punitive...
alone forever.
Yeah,
you know,
that,
the
that
hall,
was...
the woman, this kind of stuff. So I kind of wonder if, like, maybe this is just kind of... All of this is still speaking to that place of possibilities that fan fiction and fan art creates.
Which is a lovely way of phrasing it, for sure. The idea of that, like, the narrative... The official narrative, said here, obviously, in quotes, isn't the end-all of the narrative. So there's, drop my pen again, there's, obviously authors know about fan culture, and that's, like, as I mentioned earlier, there's metatextual references to this, like, Supernatural's really into talking about fan fiction, and I don't really have any other examples off the top
Lost
of my head.
Lost took a lot of advice from fan internet culture.
Yeah.
And probably didn't do them very well. Good.
And I know the X-Files, like, at least acknowledged it with just character naming and stuff.
Sherlock as well.
Sherlock definitely plays into the fan culture, even just, like, the actors and producers do. But there's also authors who roundly reject the idea of fan culture. Like, George R. R. Martin hates fan fiction. He's okay with fan art, but he hates fan fiction. J.K. Rowling is okay with it. She doesn't like drug use or underage sex.
But in terms of, like, I think I only heard about this George R. R. Martin disliking it from you.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I remember, it's because it's kind of his universe, his characters.
Yeah.
He put so much effort into creating them and crafting them and giving them such a such a world that he thinks that, you know, part of the creativity is gone from the people who take from others.
Yeah, that's what, and like, I will obviously be paraphrasing, but yeah, George R. R. Martin's thing is that it's not a creative act to invest yourself in someone else's universe, whereas, like, the transliteration of making it into art is, which is interesting, and I'm sort of drawing the parallel in my head to, like, Dan Harmon's reaction to seeing the season of Community that he wasn't show running, where he was, like, very offended because it was his characters doing something his characters would never do. Which is, I think, George R. R. Martin's reaction also.
Yeah, and it's weird because it's, you know, how do you own the characters once you put them out into the world?
Exactly.
And also, it's not like the, as I mentioned with the anxiety of influence, it's not like they're wholly original characters. George R. R. Martin in particular in his books, like, play off of common tropes and, like,
yeah,
in a really interesting way, in that he, like, you know, subverts them and plays around with them in some cases, but they're still, like, tropes.
Mm-hmm. And, but also historically based, which is...
yeah, and he's also, like, taking things from, like, medieval culture and,
right,
and
which,
politics and stuff.
Which, if we tap into, like, anxiety of influence and we accept that, like, nothing is new ever, then what's the difference if we just...
Yeah. What I've been thinking about just while you were talking isn't really on topic, but it's kind of about, I wonder what the, it's all well and good when we talk about, you know, the new possibilities and the people's creating it and creating new narratives, but isn't it all serving, like, a very capitalistic purpose, which is to take people's passion for, like, you know, I'm sure, I think art's really important, but for Sherlock, the television show, individually, and, like, giving it its own advertisement on Tumblr.
I guess, unpack that for me, because if, like, I mean, in terms of, I guess, like, visibility, is that what you're talking about?
And
like,
passion.
Sure. So tie that into capitalism for me.
Oh, it's that the ends in which it's working for is to make more money for the people producing the television
mm-hmm.
show.
And so do you think that just in general, that's, like, creating a piece that evokes that passion is a capitalist?
No, I'm saying, like, the creation of fan fiction, especially I'm thinking on Tumblr, mm-hmm. and not the narrative work, pretty much just serves as an alternate realm of advertising that the show doesn't have to pay for. It's paying for with, like, the audience labor, which they have to put in.
Yeah. I was just thinking about the comment that you made earlier about, like, the cunt calling thing, where it was like, you know, why is it determined by how the others receive the thing versus the experience the person has responding or dealing with the situation or, in this case, creating the fan fiction. So, I don't see a huge difference. It's true, like, it might serve this function. It might, you know, attract people to the show. It might be on Tumblr in that way. But I think part of what makes fan fiction, like, so interesting is that it's something that is so personalized and so uniquely fulfilling or kind of creating something within the individual who's creating it. So should we be evaluating it in response to how it's received by others or what effect it has on other people, like, making them watch the show?
Yeah, I always, when it comes to art, sometimes I just get, like, really sad about it because I go in between, like, oh, it's so important, you know, this art is so important, it's so great, whatever. And then sometimes I'm like, it's meaningless, like, we could be doing a lot more for people. But that's not important to this topic. I'm just saying that's where it came from, like, a place of just sadness, of, like, no matter what interesting things, it's still in a realm of capitalism.
But there's a possibility, too. I keep going back to possibilities.
You love possibilities.
I do. About, you know, saying doing sort of things, making things better for other people or whatever you're sort of referring to. But in terms of creating representations of, like, yourself and people that aren't seen, people who don't have voices. So there's, like, a possibility for that within fan fiction as well, to sort of give representation to things that don't get represented.
And it's not like it has to be capitalist or it has to be non-capitalist. Like, there can be, and are, of course, like, blurry, ambiguous ways of you know, being active and being passive.
Sure.
It doesn't have to be one or the other when it comes to fan culture.
I also just briefly want to touch on the idea that, like, the creative impulse to create a work within a fan community. So the creative impulse to, like, write fan fiction rather than to write, like, original fiction, and what that might be based on, and if we have any theories about that. Like,
I do.
Yeah, so.
Okay, so within, like, feminist film, like, especially since the 70s and, like, Laura Mulvey and stuff, it's all about Sky, taking these dominant tropes that exist, or dominant narratives, and trying to subvert them. And they exist, and that's it. And so, I forget your question, but I'm going to continue talking as if I'm answering it.
Please.
So, basically what feminist film has done since then is just constantly been nodding to those dominant tropes while trying to subvert them. So there's kind of, like, this reestablishment of it. So there's this film, which I'm going to find the name of and the filmmakers who did it, but they're two lesbian women, and they recreate scenes within their kitchen and home of mainstream films. So they kind of are creating their own little fan art piece, but it's actually just, like, you know, real art, if I'm going to make that distinction at all. So they do,
yikes,
like, Apocalypse Now. I know, I don't mean it, but, like, it would be in a gallery, and it has been in galleries. That's what I mean.
That's a whole other podcast, Tara.
I'm just saying that it's labeled as art because it's like that.
It's in galleries because it's capitalistic. Because people pay to see it, Tara.
Let's keep moving away. And so they do, like, Apocalypse Now with two women as the leads going through, like, dishwashers and stuff.
Yeah.
And so it's taking this canon, but it's reappropriating it from, like, a feminist lens in order to critique that canon itself.
Right.
What was your question? Did I answer it?
No, similar. And I guess I would like to do this.
Oh, why do it? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I would like to approach it anecdotally again, I guess, because I assume we all have opinions, but I know personally whenever I've, like, read fan fiction or written it, I've always found it very rewarding and interesting and just nice for my ego to be involved in a community that has, at least in this one precise way, the same values. And so it's very easy to be, like, praised and supported in these ways by people who, like, are appreciating that you're contributing creatively to the same system of beliefs, again, in this, like, small, tiny way, which is, like, one thing that we all like. And so I've always found that these small communities are that. Like, it's almost a humanistic thing. It's that these people that are, like, attracted to each other because of the things they like, and I've always, like, been of the mind that what we like is important and isn't something to be dismissed.
Yeah, and also this is really quick.
Yeah, do it.
Fan fiction is, like you said, it's a very supporting community, and it's usually not very, like art... I'm so sorry. Like, normal art,
good art
communities, it's very, like, competitive, and people don't
yes.
want to see other people prosper. Whereas,
yes.
like, people are very encouraging online. And does that have to do with something, does that have to do with women being the dominant writers of fanfiction and being in that culture? Skye?
I don't have an answer to that, but I have a question that I wanted to pose, and maybe it's too big for the, like, the last, like, 4 minutes of the podcast, but, like, I basically, one of the things I was wondering in response to what you guys were talking about was, like, this idea that a lot of feminist work is in response to something else.
Yeah,
and,
it's very interesting.
It is
yeah.
interesting, and I'm wondering if there is a difference in the sort of feminist impact it makes, or the feminist, like, not, like, quality per se, but, like, the feminism meter of something in work that's created sort of quote-unquote anew versus work that's created in response to something. And, like, why is it... other than the fact that you're subverting something, like, that existed and was already problematic or something, like, why is it so common to respond, and is it better or worse to make something new or respond, or why?
I have an answer. Because yeah. I just gave a presentation on this very topic.
She's ready.
So I'm very
guys.
Ready. And especially when it comes to film theory. Because that is that's the dominant understanding of, like, how to make feminist film. Is to, you know, subvert other tropes. But now, in the, like, since the 90s, it's kind of been like, but doesn't that just reinforce that they are these things? You know?
Yeah.
That there are these, like, very phallic symbols in film if you keep just talking about it. As well as,
I mean, I hate that argument, but I would more ask, like, are feminists, why are they always the responders? Or the ones who consume and respond, rather than the ones that produce the thing to be consumed.
Because there is no, we don't have the power. Because there's
a
reason feminism exists.
Are they always the ones responding?
Yeah, that's my other question.
Because I don't know. I, like, from, you know, going on some fanfiction site the night just to sort of brush up, there was some stuff that I read that I wouldn't necessarily, I don't know who the author was.
That's
that
fine.
Seem,
it's not like we're gonna.
Well, I mean, like, I don't know if they were like a man, a woman, or
no, sure,
whatever.
Yeah.
But it didn't seem very feminist.
Yeah.
I guess, and I guess I don't know how you deem what feminist is and what isn't feminist. Yeah, I don't know. Like, how do we know it's always feminist or someone who
yeah.
identifies?
And
as
I
feminist.
Think when it comes
yeah.
to fan culture and fan fiction, I don't think that the individual pieces are like. Necessarily feminist act or narrative.
I agree. There can
but
be
I think as a
yeah.
whole, the act of doing it is doing something along the lines of what feminism is going for.
I totally agree. Like, even if the stories don't subscribe, then just, yeah. yeah.
The as a whole, it's kind of doing something different
even
than
if someone writes a really anti-feminist piece
there are
of
a
fiction.
Million anti-feminists.
Oh,
I probably, like, the majority is something that I would call not feminist, you know. But I think the act of it is different from, like, the product.
Oh, and I gotta say, like, personally, the stuff I read, like, none of it passes the Bechdel test. There's, like, barely female characters in the stuff I read.
Yeah, I always focused on women.
Except for that's not entirely true, because I guess lately, especially more, I've been more interested in female stuff. I was thinking, just as we were talking, about a thing that really thrills me about fan communities is, I think we talked about this when we were watching The Legend of Korra. We were talking about how great
Korra's arms are.
Yes, obviously, but Korra and Asami would be as a couple.
Oh, yeah.
And then I was like, that fan art definitely exists.
And
I looked it up and it did. And there's something that I really find amazing about the idea, like, if we want to go back to anxiety of influence and reject it, like, I love the idea that the thoughts I'm thinking have existed before and I can find people who have put them creatively into the ether. And so we were like, ah, Korasami, that'd be great. And then I found, like, a million sketches of that. And I was like, yeah, other people think this, and here's what it would look like. And there's something about that that, like, even if I depoliticize it, I just find personally very lovely. I like that is, I like that the universe exists in that way.
Yeah, I don't think it's possible that any one person is going to come up with a new idea. I think it always works from, like, realms of communities and, like...
Yeah.
I guess some people take it even further than communities, where, like, across the globe there's some sort of, like, human connection or whatever, but I don't have to go into that. But I just want to clarify my last comment, which I was like, women... maybe the community is more encouraging because it's women. I don't mean that just because, like, women are automatically encouraging. Because
we're motherly.
Open up that
the warmth of maternal.
Our bosoms.
Though women are different than men.
Sure.
And fanfiction is not art.
Fanfiction is not art, guys.
It's not art. And women are all very caring. I know.
Nailed
and
it.
I never come back.
So, yeah, we brought you on, but do you have any, like...
Final thoughts?
Yeah, yeah, like, do you have any sort of anything to share that we've kind of sidelined you out of by just talking
specifically
about,
like... my last comment?
Well, actually, I was just sort of coming back to the whole feminism and fanfiction and it being a feminist kind of act, possibly. Mm. I wonder if there's, like, sort of the other side of that, too. There's, like, the feminist side of sort of carving out a space for yourself when, like, there hasn't been these places for various peoples and bodies before. But what about the act of, like, kind of appropriation? And I don't want to use colonize in a metaphorical kind of sense, but, like, in a sense, sort of taking what isn't
but
yours.
Yes.
And
no, no, no. But
I'm
that's,
going to,
that's,
unfortunately,
no, no, no.
Colonization is not a metaphor. But, like, honestly, like, when you talk about colonization, maybe it's the opposite of a feminist act sometimes, or... Like, you know, it could be sort of both things and sort of complicating that idea.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Oh, just blew my mind.
God damn it! I know! Okay,
we have
part
sorry.
Two!
Such
no,
a good
I
idea.
Need
you to repeat it.
What, seriously?
Yes, I need you to
okay.
repeat it.
So,
it's so
I mean, we all jumped in too fast.
Really
okay,
good.
So while fan fiction could be a feminist act of carving out a space for different people, it could also be the opposite of a feminist sort of act and be like a form of colonization and appropriation. So maybe it is the, what's the opposite of feminism? Patriarchal, I suppose? I don't know. I don't want to set up that.
No, the idea of it's carving out a space that, like,
it
is taking something over.
Yeah, at what point is it sort of this?
Ah, that's amazing!
Yeah, I guess what is the tipping point?
Maybe it's all in the intent.
No, tell me what the tipping point is.
What
is it?
I don't know.
I think we should leave it here. I think that's a great place for everyone to just, like,
I just wanted to
think about it
a little bit.
No, that's fascinating. I just want you to have a joke about Harry Potter.
I love this new formula for episodes where we talk about something for an hour and then Mel comes in and
says
it throws it all.
They're like,
all
oh, that's
it. We don't know what to do.
I fucked up, Kara.
It's okay. You're just going to have to go underground. Cool, great, that was a good ending.
Yeah, interesting. So maybe there's going to be a part two in a little while when we can all get together and we can talk about fanfiction as the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
So, until then, I'm Kate, this is Kara.
Oh, do we do this as our outro now?
You say goodbye.
Nothing has ever happened like
this. No, we don't have outros, we're figuring it out.
Goodbye.
Sky.
Goodbye.
And Mel the Complicator.
And maybe I'll see you later.
Visit us on a website of onesbound.com, and until next time, happy... Or not, you dumb...